Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, we speak to Michelle. She is a special guardian to a grandson and a PhD researcher at Leeds Trinity University, looking specifically at family contact in kinship and guardianship arrangements. Michelle shares her personal story, the circumstances that led to her and her partner becoming special guardians, as well as offering insight into the challenges that are present in the wider community. Michelle is honest and frank in relation to her experience and shines a light on many families' experiences. As always, if you've experienced of special guardianship, adoption or fostering from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter page, or you can email us at andfpodcast@gmail.com.
My name's Michelle and I've been a special guardian for coming up to, well, just over actually 6 years now. And it's my grandson that I'm special guardianship for. And I became a special guardian, to be honest, I think it was coming for quite a while because my daughter, she's got personality disorder and quite a few mental health issues caused by a traumatic brain injury that she suffered as a young child. So she really struggled with parenting and she tried hard, but it slipped. You know, it got worse and worse. We tried to support her a lot with the parenting aspect. She was only young, 18 at the time. And she'd also experienced some domestic violence in pregnancy, which, you know, she was really suffering with her mental health. And things just deteriorated and it became quite obvious that my grandson had been quite badly neglected. I worked full time at this time, tried to do my best, taking him on weekends and things, but it was really affecting him and it was becoming quite dangerous. So I basically gave her an ultimatum and I said, you either contact social services yourself and get some support or I'll have to contact them. So she did contact them, came out straight away and was like, it's not safe for him to be here at the moment. Can anyone take him? So obviously I was at work. They phoned me up and immediately I said, yeah, I can take him. Initially, it was just a temporary thing while she cleaned the house up a bit, sorted some things out, made it a bit more safe for him to return. And they offered support. It was put under a child protection plan straight away. So that sort of says the severity of what they thought were happening. That went on for a while. She made some improvements. Bernardo's got involved and offered her some support, which was really good. She did improve for a while, and then it kind of slipped again. So he went, it had gone on to a child in need plan by this time. It had been downgraded, and then it started to slip, and then it went back up to child protection. And to be honest, this was going on for around 18 months, which is quite a long time, really, for services to be offering support. And it just got to the point where they said, this isn't working. It's, you know, it keeps slipping. We're really looking at, you know, starting care proceedings unless somebody could take him. So he came to live with me on a child arrangements order. We had like family group conferencing and things. It became clear that he wasn't really going to be able to go back anytime in the immediate future. And that's when social services spoke to me and said, would you consider special guardianship? And I was like, well, what is special guardianship? You know, I've never even heard of this before. So they said, oh, you need to speak to a solicitor. It were all very like up in the air. And to make matters more complicated at this point, I was still trying to work full time. And I'd also just had a stillbirth myself, which obviously, so I was going through quite a traumatic period. Yeah. And then there was all this extra pressure of thinking, right, I need to have my grandson permanently. It's not just going to be a thing that's going to be for a few months. This is life-changing. My partner that I'd been with for 4 years at the time, he didn't have any children to his previous marriage. So the stillbirth we'd had was his child. And it was really hard for him as well. And I just felt at the time that social services didn't really fully understand the complications of things that were going on within our family, and the impact that it would have. Although saying that, as soon as this was offered, I knew that this was something I was going to do. And I think I've heard that from the special guardians I've spoke to. It's like your family, you just do this, you know, it's your grandchild. There's no kind of debate in it. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have like the support that you really need.
Because even, because thinking about the years leading up to that sort of question, your own personal circumstances, but actually what sort of being a bystander to what were really complicated experiences for your daughter and your grandson, that must have been really hard to sort of spectate.
Yeah, and I think as well, that's something in terms of special guardianship and sort of going forward, and I'll come back and discuss this more later, I'm now doing a PhD around birth parent contact, is one of the things as a grandma is that, yeah, you're a grandma to your grandchild, but you're also a mum or a father if you're, you know, to your child. And you've tried to support them for so long. And then suddenly you come under this sort of legal framework that says, well, actually, contact's got to be so many times a year or so often, and the child's got to be kept safe, which, of course, that is paramount. Yeah. The child's safety is paramount. But there's also like a lot of complexity because your relationship with your own child has to take a back burner. And it can be quite difficult because you feel like you're almost kind of dropping all the support that you were giving your own child, which again, like I say, is understandable because you've got to put the child's needs first. But I think it's such a complex situation when it's your own family that you're, and I think with special guardianship, because it's designed to last till the child's 18, it makes it even more difficult because that parent's got to come to terms with the fact that it's highly unlikely that they're ever going to have their child back. It is really is a kind of sort of last case scenario, you know, you've had all your chances and it's unlikely. So that your child, you know, the birth parent, they're coming to terms with their own grief, regardless of the circumstances of what the child suffered. They're still having to come to terms with that fact that they're not going to parent that child again. And so they've got their own grieving process, and you've got to withdraw yourself probably at a time when they're feeling very lost and they're needing somebody to support them.
And your instinct, your parenting instinct is almost always to step in and support your child. So it feels like it's very, you're torn, you know, there's no right answer, is there? But there is, but there's not.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult. And I suppose like time's a great healer, and over time things kind of find their own groove and you get into like a pattern of like support and things. But again, with families and with men, you know, people that have mental health conditions, there's so many swings and roundabouts and up and downs that it's not something where, this is another reason why going forward, I chose to do a PhD in birth parent contact, is there's no kind of formula for birth parent contact. And I think often in that court situation, it's like they listen to the social worker's recommendations, and it's sometimes it's very unclear as to why the social worker's recommending the frequency of contact or the place of contact or whether it should be supervised or unsupervised. I don't think there's always a lot of clarity around the reasoning behind that. I felt that this is something that is quite a complex situation and needed a bit more investigation, really, through my own experience and just speaking to other special guardians.
Because just as I've sort of totally sidetracked your story, so we will get back to that. But I was just thinking, you know, then, you know, in some ways, you know, it's the state legislating how often you can meet your daughter as well.
Yeah.
Which feels really peculiar.
Yeah, you don't really sort of see them at all in between contact on like a regular basis because you've got to kind of take that step back. Because if you start to blur them boundaries, then, you know, the next thing you know, they'll be thinking they can just drop in anytime they want. And you've got to make sure that you're 100% in your mind putting the child first. And I think whilst I imagine most special guardians always have that at the front of their mind, it doesn't mean that it's easy. And I think sometimes it's kind of brushed over as, oh, well, this has been arranged. You just stick to it. And all the other sort of complications that come with it and the feelings and, you know, you're losing, I think as a special guardian, you lose two things. You lose the relationship with your own child, but you also lose your relationship with your grandchild as a grandparent, because yeah. Now all of a sudden you're becoming a parent to that child. So you kind of grieve that ability to sort of just have your grandchild over and spoil them and, you know, do all the things that grandparents yeah. do, like, you know, buy them sweets they don't usually have, or let them watch, stay up late, watch movies. And, yeah. you know, so you're losing that fun. Kind of, yeah, all that fun aspect. And you're suddenly having to become this grandparent that has to, you know, set boundaries and discipline that child. And that is really difficult as well, because you've gone from having one relationship with a child to a totally different relationship. And at the same time, you're losing the relationship that you have with your own child. So I feel that there's not a lot of consideration given to that in terms of support. And it's hard, because you think, well, what support would you give somebody that's going through all this? And at the time, I mean, I know myself personally, being quite sort of a pragmatic, sort of strong-willed person that just gets on with things, I was like, oh, well, you know, I'll just take all this in stride and I'll just get on. And it's only maybe a bit later down the line where you sort of like look back and reflect and you think, how have I even got to this point? You know, how have I worked my way through this? And
yeah,
it's such a complex situation.
Yeah. So can it is fascinating. And the more you sort of, it's like this onion you peel and you think it becomes more complicated. So you are then in the, back to your story, you're in a position where you're asked the question, are you going to do this? You know, and so, yeah. And you said there is no. It takes quite a unique individual to be able to resist that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think as well, I mean, like I say, we'd gone through our trauma of a stillbirth. And, you know, my partner, I mean, he was like, I don't know if I can do this. You know, it's such a life-changing decision. And he had a good relationship with my grandson. But it's different having a child over on a weekend and having to support that child lifelong throughout the life and having them there 24/7 and being that person that's responsible. And to be quite frank, I'd have to say, you know, I'm asking you if you'd consider doing this, but if you have to walk away because you can't, then I totally understand. And to be put in that situation in your relationship, especially after what we've been through together, is a really kind of difficult position to be in. And it did cause a lot of tension for us at the beginning. Over time, you know, he decided that he couldn't leave, you know, he wanted to be with me and he wanted to be a father figure, I suppose, to my grandchild. But that's been hard for him, you know, especially on the back of the loss of his own child. Ironically, yeah. Going back to this story, a few months later, just before the special guardianship pod went through, I did fall pregnant again. So we have now got a child who's six. But he has quite significant learning disabilities and autism, which we didn't know that, you know, we never knew that that would happen when we took special guardianship. And again, it still wouldn't change what we did, but it's just made our family situation a lot more complex again, you know. So yeah, it's, I think that complexity around sort of family life and relationships just needs a little bit more understanding, I think, and research and thinking how can we support these families, because I think, and you know, I don't want to diminish anything with adoption or fostering, but you choose to do that because you want a child, you know, you think, you know, if you're adopting a child, it's usually either for a reason that you can't maybe have a child of your own naturally, or you just choose that that's how you want to have your children. But you're making that conscious choice that, oh, you know, I really want a child, yeah, almost like you do when you fall pregnant naturally. You plan for it and you make that choice. But with special guardian, it's just kind of thrown on you. I don't think nobody ever thinks, oh, well, I hope to look after my grandchild full time one day. I just don't think that when you have a grandchild.
It sort of goes against the flow of the natural order of things, doesn't it? It sort of puts you, does it feel like you're living sort of in an alternate world compared to your peers and people, you know, your friends of a similar age?
Yeah, I mean, it does a little bit. I mean, there's two sort of aspects to that. The first aspect is I'm looking after my grandchild. So when I go to school, for instance, to pick him up, it's like all the other people there are parents, you know, and they're probably a little bit younger than me, and they're all just picking up the children normally, which is fine. So it does make you feel like a little bit of an outsider. And then on other occasions as well, so, you know, you go to the hospital. So not long after my grandson came to live with us, we went away for a weekend to coast, and he was kicking a football around on the car park, which he shouldn't really have been doing anyway, slipped on some gravel and split his head open. So we had to phone an ambulance. So then I'm in the ambulance with him, taking him to hospital. Luckily, it was nothing too serious. But they're like saying, oh, well, have you got parental consent? And I had to explain all the special guardianship thing. And I didn't have the, because we're on holiday, I didn't have the special guardianship papers with me at hand. And so there's quite a few situations where you do feel like people just don't understand, and you do feel a bit of an outsider, you know, taking him to dentist, and you've got to go through it all again and explain. Initially at the school, they didn't realise that it wasn't appropriate for my daughter to come and pick him up from school, but only I could pick him up from school, because they were like, well, she's his birth parent, so she must have parental rights. And I said, she does, because with a special guardianship, birth parents do keep the parental rights, but they can only exercise in certain situations. And the special guardian's parental rights supersede the birth parents. And I was like, yeah, well, no, she can't just come and pick him up from school whenever she wants. And again, they had to speak to social workers to clarify that. So there's almost this thing where you're constantly having to explain your situation and your story.
And in many regards, it's a very personal story as well, isn't it? It's very private, and, you know, it's no one's business unless you want to share it. But actually, you've been put in situations where you have to sort of share stuff that's not necessarily you're comfortable sharing.
Yeah, I mean, even like, you know, getting a passport and things like that. I had quite a lot of issues getting a passport. And even though I'd sent the special guardianship order, but because the court only printed it on like A4 paper, it wasn't like on any fancy embossed like certificate, like a birth certificate. They were like, oh, we don't think this is genuine. So then they had to ring the court up and double check with the court that it was genuine. And so just all these things that you just take for granted normally, just that little bit more complicated. So there is like quite a lot of situations where you do feel a bit different and you feel a bit of an outsider. But I mean, also I am an older parent as well, sort of like I've had my first children to my first husband, and then obviously I've got divorced and I'm now with another partner, and we've obviously got our 6-year-old now. So I am a kind of an old parent in that sense as well. So I think you feel a bit different anyway as an older parent. Yeah. But I think being a parent to a grandchild does make you feel a little bit out of an outsider, and you don't have those same social circles that you build up.
Yeah.
Because I started looking after him when he was almost 4. You know, when you have your own child, you go to like these parent and toddler groups and things like that, and you get that sort of friendship circle and people that you know. But I'd not had opportunity to build that up with my grandson. So I was kind of going to school and starting school with not really knowing anybody in the local area that had children his age. So it has been difficult. And also he has difficulties, you know, parenting a child that's been through quite a lot of trauma is different to parenting a child that's you know, being with you since birth and being nurtured and cared for properly. And, you know, he's got developmental trauma and is a lovely boy in that he's not aggressive or, you know, violent. And I know that that is an issue that I've heard some special guardians speak about. You know, I think that, did you do something for kinship this morning around
violence?
I thought I'd seen something, an email come through about that. But I know that that is a thing. And luckily I've not experienced that. Luckily I've managed to get him an EHCP plan and he's going to a partnership high school next year, so I've managed to get him a lot of support in school. But again, that's something that I know can be a struggle. I think, like I say, I'm a bit of a pragmatic person and I've got a background in health and social care. So I'm kind of, I know the system a little bit, not so much a child system. Yeah. I was more into adult social care, but coming from that background, I knew the things out there and that I had to be nosy and find out what was out there and what I could access.
Yeah.
But for somebody,
well, that was sort of my next question really was in relation to the support that you were offered. And, you know, when you, after the initial order had been made, were you signposted? Was there a service? Was, you know,
no, I anything? Mean, the order was granted and they basically said, oh, we'll review after a year. If you need anything, you can just ring the front door, basically. At that time, there was no, like, kinship team as such. There is now. And so I knew, because, like I say, because of my background, I knew that if I did need support, I'd have found a way to access it, you know, and I'd have probably stamped my feet and made a fuss until I got what I needed. But I think as well, because I told social care that I worked with adults with like autism, learning disabilities, and I was from an adult social care background, they immediately assumed that I'd just be this sort of like pick everything up really easily and I'd know what to do. And you know, we went through the assessment process, which was quite invasive, really. You know, it's really personal, probably similar to what you go through as an adopter. You know, they really want to know the ins and outs of everything that's going on. They had to speak to my ex-husband, they had to speak to my partner's ex-wife and all this sort of character references and, you know, police checks, all those kind of things. And I wasn't really worried that they'd turn around and say, oh, you know, you're not suitable. But I think, again, it's just so, like, you have to sort of tell everything. You know, they wanted to know about my childhood and if I'd experienced any abuse childhood, and, you know, and it's, again, it's just that thing of just going through all your own traumas and having to drag everything up as part of the assessment process. But then when it actually came to getting the order, it was just like nobody's there. You don't see anybody. And I've heard this a lot when I spoke to other special guardians, and I've heard it in my research that I've started doing for my PhD, is that it's like you feel like social services are like watching you and on your back and wanting to know everything that you're doing in the assessment process and in the run-up to having the order. But then it's like, right, you've got the order now, see you later.
You crack on.
Yeah, just get on with it kind of thing. Initially, we did get a small financial allowance, but they didn't tell us about that. It was only because I found out from somebody else that you could get an allowance and I spoke to them about it. And they went, oh, yeah. Yeah, we can do a financial assessment, in a kind of like, oh no, she's found out and asked, kind of, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I had to find it out for myself. Nobody was going to tell me. But then that stopped after 2 years. And then they said, oh, well, you're earning too much money, even though I'd gone part-time by then. My partner was earning too much money. So they said, you're not entitled to it anymore. Which, you know, I understand there's people in worse situations than me that probably really need that money desperately. But I'd had to go from working like 40 hours a week and earning like £22,000-£23,000 a year to go to working £16 a week and earning less than half of that. So, you know, I'd still lost out a lot financially for the special guardianship. You know, I probably would have gone back to work full time after my maternity leave with my son, but when you've got two children to find childcare for, it makes a big difference to just having one child. So we kind of had to work things around, and I had to go part-time. And eventually, I ended up giving up my job because my other son's needs are very high, and I needed to focus on getting him the support he needed and medical appointments and assessments for him and things. But again, you kind of lose out financially as well.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's a hidden community. Yeah. And it's a hidden, you know, even, you know, before we started, we were talking about the podcast and how it's, you know, there's lots of similar things, but the special guardianship remains hidden. But then you've gone on to sort of, you know, you saved in a master's focusing in on contact.
Yeah.
And now you're doing a PhD. So firstly, where on earth do you find time for a PhD?
Yeah, everybody says that to me. So when I gave up work, like I said, to focus on my son and his needs and things, I knew that I'd have to do something because I have a mind that needs to be active and something for me as well, you know, something that I was interested in that I wanted to do. So I decided to do a master's in family support because I noticed there was one at the local university, which was the first of its kind at that point. So I thought, oh, this sounds really interesting. And because I'd done all the, because I'd been through everything I'd been through with my grandson, and I'd had a lot of experience of like child protection meetings, children in need meetings, family group conferencing, and all these kind of things. I had all this personal experience. I thought it'd be really good to sort of see that from the other side. So the family support masters, it focused on it from more of a leadership level, and I found it so interesting. So I did that part-time, and the last module was basically an empirical dissertation, and you had a choice to either look at the current research or to do your own small piece of research.
Right.
So I chose to do empirical research, and I looked at birth-parent contact and special guardianship, and I just did a very small study. Spoke to a couple of special guardians, a couple of practitioners, just to get sort of the two sides of the coin around birth-parent contact. And I really enjoyed that, and I got a distinction in the end. So that was part-time, and my supervisor, my course lead at the time, she kept saying, this is really interesting research. You should consider doing a PhD. We've got some studentship applications coming up. I think you should go for it. And I'm like, no, I just don't have time. And studentships are full time as well. And I'm thinking, no, I can't do this. It's too much. I spoke to my partner and he were like, Michelle, people don't just ask you to do PhDs. They obviously see something in you. You need to go do this. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity, especially if they're saying they think you can get a studentship. You know, you're not going to have to fund it yourself. So it's fully funded and the fees are paid. And I get like a stipend. So I thought, right, well, I'll do a proposal and I probably won't get it. Then I did the proposal and I'm like, oh, we want you to come for interview. So then I went to interview and I'm like, probably not got it. So in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I'm probably not going to get this. And then I thought to myself, if I don't get it, I might just do it part-time, you know, self-fund. And then they were like, oh, congratulations. And I'm like, oh, dear. Oh, no, what have I done?
Crikey.
At first, I was kind of like a bit taken aback. And then again, I chatted with my partner again and we discussed it. And he swapped some things around at work so that I could have a bit more time. And it is full time, but they are quite flexible with it because it's my own research project and it's not something that I have to be in a lab, say, to do at certain hours of the day. It is quite flexible, so, you know, I fit around school pickup times and things like that. So I've started doing it and I am really enjoying it.
Excellent. Give me the title, because titles are hugely important for PhDs. What's your title?
Yeah, so it's Special Guardianship and it's Birth Parent Contact for Special Guardian Families. And it looks, I mean, it could change slightly. I'm just in first year. So my first study, which I've started already, is speaking. It's interpretive phenomenological analysis. So it's very in-depth about experience, you know, just those personal experiences. Because I feel that this topic, there's not a lot of research out there. So it's more exploratory just to find out, you know, really in-depth detail what's going on for special guardian families. So my first study is speaking to special guardians themselves around birth-parent contact. And they're only small sample sizes. So I've spoke to 5 special guardians and I'm just sort of in the middle of analysing all the data. And so it's fun. And then I'm looking next year to speak to birth parents, because I feel that it's a bit of a triangle. There's the special guardian, the birth parents and the children. And I think birth parent stories are not really heard. There is a little bit of research out there, more around kinship care and birth parent contacts. There's quite a bit of Australian research, but there's not much in the UK. And I feel that birth parents, to me, I feel that if all the support needs for the child, special guardian and the birth parents are addressed, then it's going to make it better for the child. That's how I see it. I think, you know, if birth parents are coming to contact and they're not getting help with the drink problem, or they're not getting help with the mental health, they're going to be coming to contact, you know, they'll be coming irregular, they'll be letting children down, they might be coming and causing arguments or saying inappropriate things, and that makes the quality of the contact poor. And I think to get that good quality contact for the child, it's really important that it's addressed. The birth parents' needs are addressed as well. And that's not to say that special guardians probably don't have a lot more needs than the birth parents. They've got the child, they need the support for that child, and they need the support for themselves. But part of special guardianship orders say that where possible, contact should take place. So for that contact to be good quality for the child to understand their story, the child to feel comfortable, the child to feel happy and want that contact, I think it's important that birth parents take into consideration as well. And I think at the moment, knowing from my own experience, once my daughter did get quite a bit of support while she still had a grandchild living with her, but once the special guardianship order started, nobody checked on her afterwards. Nobody said, do you need any support now? You know, nobody addressed that she was suffering a trauma of losing a child and that she might need support with that. And I think that sort of looking at the support, and it's hard because, you know, especially in some cases, I mean, birth parents can have done horrific things. You know, they may have treated their children not very well. You know, there's abuse, there's some really horrible things that have gone on. But if the social workers and the judges are saying that it's appropriate for them to have contact, then they should get support that they need with their problems too. Because to me, it just makes sense for the child that it's just everything's going to be more amicable and it's better quality contact for that child.
And I guess within the sector, there's probably a wealth of knowledge or understanding, and whether it's well applied or not in relation to sort of adoption and contact and fostering and contact. But this seems like an area that's, again, it's just in the shadows, because I guess maybe presumptions and biases and people just saying, well, just get on with it. But actually, as you say, in some ways, much more nuance and complications around those. You know, how can you not, you know, as a special guardian coming into a situation where you've got your child and your grandchild?
Yeah.
Again, you've got to be on your mettle, haven't you, to kind of, and you've got to be able to look after yourself before you can even start to support a meaningful contact.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what I've sort of experienced and what I've learned from other special guardians is that often at the beginning, there'll be some kind of like contact arrangement, and there might be 6 months of maybe supervised visits where you go to a contact centre. But then it's like, well, your family, just get on with it. You know, you sort it out, you supervise contact. We don't need social workers to sit in. Don't have to be at a contact centre, go to soft play, you know, do it in your own home, take them to the park. And that puts a lot of pressure on the special guardian because they've got that responsibility. And just in the sort of first study that I've done now, I'm seeing this theme coming out around risk and responsibility and risk and safeguarding. Because if you've got a parent that's turning up on drugs or making suicide attempts or, you know, these problems that parents have, you know, there's a reason why these children can't live with the parents. And you're now having to manage that risk. You've not got a social worker managing that risk with a risk management plan and, you know, backup if needed. You're having to manage that risk yourself and you're having to make those judgments, calls yourself. And also that's putting you in an adversarial position with your child because you're saying, well, actually, last week you turned up drunk, so you can't see your child for next few weeks until you've sorted yourself out. And it causes like conflict, you know, that's in itself is putting you in sort of a conflict situation. And you've always got to put the child first. But,
yeah,
you know, making those judgments is hard for a professional to make. So making them when you're actually within that family unit and you're having to make those kind of judgments around risk and safety, it's quite a tricky position to be in.
Yeah, I'm reflecting on, I've got a few friends who are special guardians to their grandchildren, and just reflecting on the complexity and the nuances between those relationships that are shifting and impacted by all of the reasons why they're looking after their grandchildren. That stuff hasn't just been magicked away.
Yeah.
It just feels like an impossible task is too much. It's not an impossible task, but it feels like it's a consuming task.
Yeah.
Where it means the possibility of normal life is just really restricted by this ongoing contact.
Yeah. And I've had a couple of special guardians say to me, you know, people think that I'm overprotective because I've had to go to school and say, make sure the parents don't pick them up. Or, you know, I've had to ring police because a parent's been outside being abusive or carrying on. I mean, even some parents have experienced violence from the children. And, you know, that is something that you need to support with, you know, you do need significant support with that. It can't be just accepted that you can put up with that kind of stuff yourself. And, you know, that's putting you under a great deal of stress. And that, again, if you're under stress, that's going to impact your relationship with the child and it's going to cause tension within the family home. And, you know, it's just a very difficult situation for any special guardian to be in.
I mean, on that basis, then you're doing the research and that there's a light, you know, someone's starting to shine a light into what is a, as you say, I mean, special guardians are, guardianship arrangements are not much over 10 years old, are they? So it is a new area of practice and a new model of parenting. But, you know, from speaking to you, it's clear we're desperate to get some, to back that up with empirical research and some understanding of what is going on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, obviously we recently had the children's social care review and, you know, there's been some positive things in there around special guardianship and kinship care. I'm not saying that I agree with everything that's in that review, but, you know, it is something that they've sort of shone a light on, I think, in that review. You know, and there's a big thing around peer support and there's great agencies like Kinship and Family Rights Group that do a lot of work and, you know, they're a fantastic resource for special guardians and kinship carers. But, you know, I think, and I do worry that they see special guardianship as a cheap option. You know, and I don't want to get too political here, but, you know, it saves a lot of money for a public purse. You know, if a child can stay within the family and they don't have to put in tons of support, they don't have to end up in a children's care home or, you know, they have to be in permanent foster care, going from one home to another. And it's great for a child. You know, if a child can stay in the family, then I think that's great. You know, if it's safe and it's good for that child to be in the family, that is a good outcome, I think, for children. Depending on situations, probably some situations where maybe it's not. But, you know, if it is a safe environment and it's a permanent placement, I feel that that is a good thing. But I don't think it should be seen as a cheap option. And I think that, you know, special guardians, if they are going to utilise special guardians more, which they seem to be doing, they really do need to have like a good, robust support package in place for special guardians. And also, like I say, a good understanding of the sort of family complexities, and that it might not just be the special guardian that needs support. They might also need to give parents support, you know, if contact is something that's recommended for that family.
Well, that's a good place to end, really. That's a really clear message on what, you know, you've been so generous with your own experience, but also you've got a real insight and a developed insight from your PhD. When is your PhD due?
Well, like I say, I've only started this year, so it's going to be 2025 no before it's complete. It's 3 years full time. So hopefully sort of in between, I'll be able to, fingers crossed, get a few things published and get some early research out there. And I'm also hoping to publish an article from my MA as well. So that's just being peer reviewed now, which is a bit scary.
Excellent.
That might be released sort of early next year. So yeah, I think it's definitely an area that does need more research, and hopefully, like I say, this all area of birth parent contact and special guardianship, you know, we will get a little bit more support. So,
well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you being so generous with your time, and wish you well with your research and with your family.
Thank you, Al.